this is based upon what? It's based upon the famous interpretation of Matovu Ohalecha Yaakov, Mishkan Osecha Yisrael. What do we say are the Ohalecha when we say Matovu Ohalecha? So these are the Ohalei Torah. And what are the Mishkan Osecha? These, of course, are the shuls, right? The shuls and the Batei Midrash. So that this is what he's referring to over here. All right, we'll finish up to the new Mishnah. Originally, there in the pasuk it's ka'ahalim, like aloes. That's the English translation. Okay, in other words, it's like trees, certain type of trees or plants or something like that. Even today, you know, what are they using with aloes? They use it also, you know, to cure all kinds of cuts and everything else and so on. You know, it's considered a great curative thing. So obviously, there's the idea, you know, that just as they can help to purify, to cleanse, to heal, and so on and so forth, so that they have this property. So the shuls and the Batei Medrash have the property also of helping people rise from a state of impurity to purity, from chova, in other words, from being condemned to punishment, to a state of sukkus that you know, God sees the great merit.
But this midrash of the Matovu, the Mishnah Tefa, the midrashim, and the Ohalecha,
the Ohalei Torah, right? Okay. Now, yeah. The last statement in the Mishnah was that Hakarei Lamachbeel Layotzo. What happens if a person recites the Krishna in the topsy turvy order? Instead of doing it in the order in which it should be said, he does it in his own way. Okay? So in that case, he has not fulfilled his obligation. Rabbi Yami Rabasi, Habako Katrid Lei Ganona the Rabbi Eloza. So, once upon a time, says, Rabbi Yami and Rabbi Asi were tying together, this is how Rashi explains it, like a chuppah for Rabbi Elazar. Okay, how did they do it? They would take trees and twist them together in order to make like a chuppah. Or they would take some other plants, but particularly trees. So there's a famous Gemara which says that, for example, when a boy was born, they would plant a certain type of tree. When a girl was, right. So the brosh and the titar or something. At any rate, you know, when it came time, or eras, so yeah, the eras, the cedar tree. So in this case, they would build the chuppah, you see, of the two trees. So they were preparing the chuppah for Rabbi Elazar. Omar Lahu, so he said to them, Atochi v'chochi eizu v'yeshvan v'yusod v'midrashis. So he said to them, look, while you fellas are busy working over there, I'll go to the base medrash and I'll see what I can pick up over there. So, the Esav Emelechu, and he says, and then I'll come and I'll tell you, know what did I hear in the base medrash? So Ozal, he went, Ashkeche Letano, and he heard the teacher, the Kotone Kamid Rabbi Yochanan, who was teaching the following in the presence of Rabbi Yochanan. He said at that particular point, this is what I heard. What? Koro v'to'o, if a person read and then he made a mistake, but he's not sure now where it is that he made the mistake. In other words, he said the wrong line, the wrong word, whatever it may be. So in that particular case, the emtsa perek yasil rosh. If he is in the middle of a perek, then he should start all over again that particular perek. In other words, let's say he made a mistake in Hoyim Shuim, then remember now where exactly he was. In that particular case, go back to the Hoyim Shemar. Bein Perek Leferek, if you're in the middle, if you're right at the juncture between one and the other, then Yachsul Leferek Rishon, then go back to the previous one. Bein Ksivo Leksivo, by this they mean you don't remember, you know, remember that at the end of the first paragraph of the Shema and at the end of the second paragraph of the Shema, we have the identical pasuk, Uksavtom Alms Zos Pesach Visharecha, right? So now let's say that you say Uksavtom, you don't remember, was this the Uksavtom at the end of the first parak, or was it the Uksavtom at the end of the second parak? So Yachzor the Chesiva Rishon, and in that case, we'll back again to Savtom in the first parak. Omalei Rabbi Yochanan. So Rabbi Yochanan said to him, Lei Shonu Eleshulei Posach B'leman Yubu Yimeichem. He says, this last statement applies only where he had not already started on Leman Yubu Yimeichem. Aval Posach B'leman Yubu Yimeichem. But if he had already said, you know, someone was just except for Shrek Leman Yubu Yimeichem, then in that case, we say, Sochein Nokap. Then he was simply going in along his usual path, the Osei. In other words, you know, he does not have to go back again to the end of the first chapter, to the first parak of the Shema, because presumably if he said, and then he said, Leman Yuyu Nechem, then in that particular case, probably it was the force of habit, and he was probably doing the right thing. So that this is our presumption. So also he came back to them, the Yom Alehu, and you know, he told them this, you know, what he had heard in the base medrash. So Amulei, they said to him, Ilu Leibonu El Shmoy Devozeh Dayenu. If we had only heard just this one teaching, it's already Dayenu. It's a big, big mitzvah that you had and we had and so on. So we conclude on this note, and Yes Hashem, next Wednesday we shall continue learning at our usual time and place. Tonight. Okay.
No pages here.
Yes, yes, yes. In the English it says 30, which would make this 31. Well, no, it doesn't work that way, I guess. Huh? I'm right.
Oh, you've got Tezayin, right.
Yeah, Tezayin. You know, we go by Jewish. And the Gemara tonight begins on Tezayin with a brand new Mishnah over there. All right. We have been talking for the past few weeks about the importance of reciting the Kriya Shema and to have Kavona when we recite it. To what extent you have to have kavana about this, we saw, you know, there were differences of opinion. One opinion is just to have it throughout the entire Shema Yisrael. Others are willing to say, okay, you should have kavana through the first paragraph. Others say that the kavana doesn't have to be through the entire first paragraph, but up to al nevavecha. And, you know, the minimum is that at least when you say Shema Yisrael, just that pasuk alone, you have to have kavana, and then after that you can say it in a regular fashion. So this was the problem with kavana. Now tonight we start with various cases where for one reason or another there's a hitch. Okay, and the Mishnah starts by talking about umnit, people who are artisans. Say they work for a builder, okay? Yeah. Alright? They could be masons, they could be, you know, whatever kind of work that they're doing, bricklayers, whatever it may be, alright? So he says, people who are employed, you know, to do work, they can recite the Shema Yisrael either on the top of a tree or on the top of a nidbach. The question is only, what is the meaning of the word nidbach? The explanation that Rashi gives for the word nidbach. All right, let's take a look at the Rashi for these two things. I'll explain it to you. All right. First of all, he talks about ha'umni, you know, the people who are employees. Okay, people who are engaged to do work. Sheheim asukim b'mlachton. They're busy with their work. Barosha ilon, either on the top of a tree, or barosha nidbach, or on the top of a nidbach. Ve'giya azman kriya shma. And the time for Krishna has just arrived, so Korin Lisham Miyad. Then in that particular case, they begin reading there immediately. In other words, where they are. Where are they? Either they're on top of the tree, or they are on the top of the nidbach. So now Rashi wants to explain what is a nidbach. Nidbach, says Rashi, is Binyan Shalan. This is a building of stones. Now he doesn't mean a house made of stone. What he means is that, let's say, for example, you build a wall made of stones, okay? And the proof that this is the meaning is because we have in the book of Ezra the word that occurs over there. It's written, Nidvachin de Eben Golol. In other words, it was, a row of stones which was made of, rolled stones or rounded stones, okay? Now, what is he saying? Therefore, what he's saying is that let's say a person is employed to work on the top of a tree. What is he doing? Obviously, he's harvesting over there, let's say. It's the most likely thing. So, in that particular case, let's say if he's busy harvesting and either he's putting the food into the basket or maybe he's throwing it down to somebody below him or whatever it may be. So, when the time has come to recite Krishna, then in that particular case, he can recite the Krishna and he doesn't have to come down from the top of the tree in order to say it. Or, if he's working on a nidbok, let's say he's doing masonry, he's building something, okay, along this row of stones, as Rashi puts it, or some people translate it, they translate it as a scaffold, alright, or on a scaffold. So, in any case, they don't have to come down in order to recite Krishna. Masha'in and Rashi'in Lazarus came with Philo. But this they are not permitted to do when it comes to reciting Shmona Esrei. For Shmona Esrei, they must have to come down. Alright, so of course the question immediately is, what is the difference between reciting Krishna and reciting the Shmona Esrei? Why does the Mishnah say that they can remain where they are when they recite Krishna, but that they have to come down on the ground in order to recite Shmona Esrei? So this is what Rashi says now. Okay? Ma'ashen and Rashoin Lasseis came with Phil. He says, Ditzluchso, good evening, David, how are you? Good evening, Bob. Says Ditzluchso, in other words, prayer, and specifically over here what he means by prayer, he means Shmona Esrei, alright? Shmona Esrei, he says, is Rachnehi. It is a plea to God that he should have mercy upon us. Oboye kavona, you must have kavona, and of course what he's saying is that you have to have kavona throughout the Shmona Esrei, because after all you're busy begging the Rebbeinu Shalom to grant you good life, to grant you good health, to forgive your sins, to enable you to be a Talmud Chokhem and things like that, so that this requires concentration on your part. You have to feel what you're saying. So therefore, Hilkoch, for this reason, Ein Mispalalim Barosha Yilon Barosha Nidvok. Therefore, they do not recite Shmona Esrei either on the top of the tree or on the top of this row of stones or scaffolding, whichever way you want to translate it. Okay. Why? The Mistofei, because they're afraid, he says, Dilmanotle, they're liable to fall. The Ein Yechonon Lamod Shom, Ela Yedeyatchak, because they can only stand over there only through the exertion of force. Umachmas biyuso lo motzi mechavni, and because of their fear that they're liable to fall down, they will not be able to concentrate. So of course, obviously, we're going to have a problem when the Gemara starts in. I mean, why? What's the matter? Krishna doesn't need the same kavona that the Shmona Esrei should be. Obviously, it should. All right. However, the Mishnah doesn't stop at this particular point, because now it goes in to another inyan, okay? Something that we touched upon before because it was quoted previously. You know where we are. We're in the Mishnah on page Tes Zayin. We started a brand new Mishnah a few minutes ago, okay? Alright, the first part of the Mishnah, I'll simply review briefly, says that if people are working, are employed, and their work calls for them to be working either on the top of a tree or on a row of stones or a scaffolding or something like that, on a high wall which is made of stones, put together or something like that. So they are not required to go down to the ground in order to recite Krishna. In other words, they can recite Krishna where they are. But, says the Mishnah, this is not so when it comes to Shmona Esrei. For Shmona Esrei, they do have to come down. So Rashi is explaining why the difference between Krishna and Shmona Esrei. And he says the difference is because for Shmona Esrei you are begging the Rebbeinu Shel Olam for all kinds of petitions, and therefore you have to have the proper frame of mind, the proper kavana, in order to do so. And if you're on the top of a tree, or if you're on top of a wall, you're not going to have the same kavana. You'll be afraid that you'll fall down from there. And therefore, if you're going to recite Shmon Esrei, then you must come down in order to do so. So this is what the first part of the Mishnah says. Now the Mishnah continues with a story. Well, not with the story. The story will come in a moment. But the Mishnah now gives another klal, another general rule. It says, Chosom potom mikriya shma, laila v'chavishoyna, v'yad v'nsoye shavis v'nayasa masa. Alright? A chosom is excused from reciting Krishna the first night of his wedded life, right? Or even up till Motzoi Shabbos, in other words, Saturday night, Imlo Somasa, if he didn't yet accomplish the deed. Naturally, we all understand what deed they're talking about. They're talking about the deed, you know, of having the first intercourse with his wife, okay? So, it's assumed, I mean, that normally the average person tries to do it on the marriage night, right? On the first night. But, you know, there are couples that are so tired out as a result of all the festivities that they'll do it the next night instead, right, or something like that, okay? So, up to even Motzei Shabbos. Of course, the question is, then, when is the wedding taking place? If it says up to Motzei Shabbos. It doesn't mean necessarily a week, you see. It doesn't necessarily, because in the days of the Talmud, marriages normally would take place either on Sunday night or it would take place on Wednesday night. Those were the two favorite nights. Gemara in Ksubas explains why those were the two favorite nights. The reason being that if he discovered that his wife was not a virgin, and she said she was a virgin, he can come the following morning to the Beis Din and say, look, I married a woman who I thought was a virgin, and she's not a virgin. And, you know, in that particular case, if the Beis Din agrees with him after questioning and so on and so forth, you know, that he really has a serious case, then in that particular case, they can
not dissolve
the marriage, but rather they cause her to lose the ksuba. The ksuba is like, I mean, we know that part of it says, you know, that the husband says that I will work for you, I'll take care of you, I'll cherish you, I'll take care of all your needs, and even, you know, you can take the shirt off my back. When? During my lifetime and even after my lifetime. In other words, this is like our insurance policy, because in those days there was no such thing as insurance. This was her insurance policy, that either if he divorced her, or if he passed away, then in that case she was granted the first rights to his estate. Okay? Theoretically, we say that the inheritance goes to the sons, according to the law of the Talmud, but in reality, the first claim on the estate of a person who passes away, or, you know, if a man is divorced, the first claim is that of the wife. She has the ksuba, she gets taken care of first, and then after that, they start him to distribute the assets.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Because she's entitled.
Out of the ketuba.
Right. Exactly.
Against the nachala.
Right. Exactly. Right. She has first claim. There's no question about
that.
Right. And then in that case, then you can start to go into the inheritance part of it and see what you can do. And even then, you know, it's not so much that the sons get. The sons may theoretically get, but if they have sisters, the sisters are entitled to be supported until such time, you know, that they get to be old enough, you know, to be a marriageable age or something like that, you see. So they also get, in other words, the sons, even though they may theoretically get the estate, but they have this obligation to support the girls first before they can take care of their own needs.
Well, then why do you have this Shtar Matana 3?
Okay,
why do we
correct.
Call it?
Because this is already given in the case of, let's say, where a man feels that he doesn't want to be guided necessarily by the laws of, you know, of Nachala,
right,
after his death, because he wants to make sure, you see, that his daughters will be well taken care of, the wife will be well taken care of. I mean, as I said, the wife, her claim is the ksuba. Okay? But a man, let's say, wants to leave a much more substantial estate to
his
wife.
That's my question. What is provided for in the ketubah? I mean,
the ketubah has a provision for either one of two things. Okay? If the wife is a virgin, then he promises her 200 zuz. How much a zuz is worth today, I don't know. Wouldn't be worth an awful lot of money, I don't think, today, but in those days it was considered a substantial amount of money. Okay? If he married either a divorcee or a widow, then in that particular case, he only is required to give her 100 zuz. Correct. Well, in the case of the divorcee or the widow, it's quite possible, you see, that they already had collected from a previous husband. So that this is the reason why, in all probability. But I suspect that your comment is not altogether wrong either. Probably it's also one of the psychological factors in it. But technically, I mean, this is what is promised in the ksuba, okay? Since today we don't know really how much Jesus is worth in monetary terms, this is why if a man feels that he wants to take adequate provision, you know, for his wife, for his children, including his daughters, then in that particular case he does it through the method that you described, namely of giving a gift during his lifetime, you see.
I think and this is a really very small value.
Right. My father bought the goat for two zuzim, right?
Right.
Okay. Right, yeah.
So
it was not the world's.
It could be.
Maybe it's expensive. I know that if you go on the capital market today and try to buy a horse or a cow or something like that, it's cost geld. It's more expensive than buying a chicken. And even chickens have gone up in value.
You
got to
realize it was an agrarian society then. That was the way of the farming.
Yeah.
So it's not going to be cheap.
Yeah.
Well,
but we don't really know. I mean, in the final analysis, how much would a zuz be worth today in terms of the purchasing power, you know, dollars and cents and so on. Right. Right. So that this is the reason why I say, I mean, today husbands make different provisions, you know, both for their wives and their children, rather than to go necessarily according to the strict din of the halacha. And this is recognized, you know, by the halacha as within the power of a person, as long as he is healthy, that he can give away as much of his future estate as he wants, because it's within his power to do so. So he can make adequate provision.
So if someone was entitled to have a dowry, which is what it is, of 100 infant sheep, that makes sense. That is a somewhat substantial inheritance.
Yeah, it would be. You're right.
Portion,
okay. Oh, definitely. I mean, a person who would get the equivalent of 100 goats, right? 100 kids. Right, okay. And sell them on the market or something like that.
Well,
it would have a substantial part.
Yeah. Take the Shtetlach in Europe.
Yeah.
A person like Tevye, for instance, he only had one cow. That was
right.
The easy thing to get and keep up. It was his whole livelihood.
Correct, it was his livelihood, and on the basis of his cow, you know, he was able to sell butter and milk and cheese.
You're talking about
and so
at
on,
that
right.
time, if a person had a goat, it's going to be expensive.
Yeah.
And 100 of them would be a really good dollar.
Right, right. Reminds me of the Arabs to this day, you know, with their herds of goats.
It's only if someone had considerable wealth beyond that.
Yeah, well, as I say, 200 zuz was considered a pretty substantial amount of money for those days. Yeah. Yeah. But that's what the Ksuba says, you know, and he says that he'll do this bechayai uvasachayai. During my lifetime, I'll provide for you, and also even after my lifetime, I will provide for you. So, this is the idea. All right. So, at any rate, a chosan then is given a certain amount of time in order to consummate the marriage. the night that he's busy consummating the marriage, he's parted from reciting Krishna because presumably he's engaged in the performance of another mitzvah. Okay? And not only because he's engaged in performing another mitzvah, as we've already learned before, but he's also worried about how his performance is going to be in performing that particular mitzvah. And since he's worried, so that this is one of the basic reasons why he is excused from reciting Krishna. So that, as I said, there are really two elements over there. One is that he's performing a mitzvah, but the other one is the fact that he's worried about how he's going to perform the mitzvah, and will he find that the young lady in question is a virgin or not, and so on, you see. So that these are the reasons why he's not able to concentrate the same way that he would be. And if he weren't able to consummate the marriage the first night, so they give him another night, until Moshe Shabbos. All right, this is what the Mishnah says. So he's potter from doing it until that time. All right, Master by Rabban Gamliel, and now the Mishnah tells us a story about Rabban Gamliel. Shenosa Isha, he married a woman, the Koro Lailo Harishona, and the very first night, the marital night, he read Krishna. Omru lo Talmido, so his disciples, his students, said to him, Limaratona Rabbeinu Shakosam Potam Kriya Shema, didn't you teach us, our teacher, our master, that a chosen is excused from reciting Krishna? Amalahim, so he said to them, Einisha me'alochem levatel heimeni malchu shema'a kusho achas. He says, I'm not going to listen to you that even for a moment I should cast aside for me the yoke of the kingdom of heaven. And even in other words, that I am a chosen, I still bear in mind the fact that I am God's servant, and I want to express my love and my devotion to him by reciting the Krishna. So this is what the Mishnah has to say. And, yes?
I'm sorry, I just back up to the first sentence. I'm sorry to skip, apologize. The word for wall, is that?
Nidbach.
Nidbach.
Nidbach, right.
Sorry.
Yeah. As I said, the word is taken in the book of Ezra, where we find it first, to mean like a wall of stones. Okay? In other words, like, for example, people will make a wall of stones in order to protect their property. Or they'll build, let's say, the side of a building and they'll make it in stone or something like that. All right. Anyway, these guys are up there putting down the stones in order to make this wall. Okay? And while they're engaged in working, all of a sudden it's time to recite Krishna. So the question is, do they have to come down from the wall in order to recite Krishna or not? And the halacha is, in this particular case, as the Mishnah states, that they can recite it on top of the wall, wherever they are. Likewise, if they were working up on the top of a tree, let's say picking fruit over there, okay? So in that particular case, they don't have to come down, but they can recite it over there. However, when it comes to reciting Shmoneh Esrei, we say then they must come down to the ground. Why? Because in the final analysis, the Shmoneh Esrei requires concentration for the entire prayer, since what are we saying? We're begging the Rabbeinu Shel Olam to grant us knowledge, to forgive our sins, to grant us good health, etc., etc. Okay? So that these things require that we should concentrate upon them, meaning we should know, we should have our heart set, and if we're going to be worried that we're going to fall off, either from the tree, from the top of the tree, or the wall that we're working on, in that particular case, the rule is that you have to come down in order to recite. So, that's pretty clear-cut, how they're reasoning at this particular point. But as we'll see, there's more to it as well.
From what you're saying, also it seems to me that this business of walking 3 steps back and forth, back from that, right?
Yeah.
And the same thing after you say, is not something that they did then. Why do we do it then?
No, we do it because it's as if we are entering the presence of a king and taking our departure from the presence of the king. This is why we step forward and step backwards.
doesn't seem that they're doing it then. They're not giving the same reason, at best, possibly, why they're getting off the tree.
No, but they okay, good. I understand what you're saying. You're saying that if they took three steps backwards, they're liable to fall off the tree, right? This we understand. But on the other hand, they don't have to begin the recital of the Shemoneh Esrei until they're down on the ground, you see. So that's not... Essentially, the problem is, you know, can they concentrate when at the same time they're afraid that they're going to fall? And obviously they cannot have that measure of concentration that they should have when they recite the Shemoneh Esrei. This is the reason why. Yes?
I just figured questions. When
we
read the beginning of the mission,
Ha-Omanim. Ha-Omanim, yes, Ha-Omanim, right.
Is that for the artists or believers?
No, neither of them.
Okay.
And Uman is an artisan, a craftsman,
okay.
Someone who works with his hands in order to create things. This is what an Uman is.
All right.
An artist in Hebrew is Oman.
Okay.
Looks almost the same thing, but there's no vav in the word for artist.
And Korin is like Koray?
Okay. The language of the Mishnah is such that even though it's Hebrew, but certain Aramaic influences are obvious. One of them is the fact that the masculine plural very often ends in Yud Nun instead of ending in Yud Mem. That's one of them, okay? But even certain spelling changes took place in the time of the Mishnah. After all, if we were to write the word Koraim, right? We would spell it Kuv, Vav, Resh, Aleph, Yud Mem, okay? What is missing over here besides the change from Mem? The Aleph. The Aleph is dropped out. Why did the Aleph drop out? Because it's silent. And as a result, there was a tendency to write words that end in Aleph as if they had ended in Hey. It's the same thing. Because in Hey, this is the normal thing. I mean, if let's take a word like Ro-in. Okay, Ro-im or Ro-in, okay? What happened to the Hey in that word? It's gone. Okay? So there was a tendency to assimilate words that ended in Aleph and make them behave the same way as words that end in hey. I'll give you an example. If you remember the very first Mishnah, the sons of Rabban Gamliel come back to him, same Rabban Gamliel, only at that point he already had his family, okay? So they come to him and they say, Father, we were at a wedding reception all night long, right? Velo korinu es shema. Okay? We didn't read the shema. Now, if it were good Hebrew, we would not say korinu. What would we say? Lo korinu, right. In other words, with an aleph. Words that end in aleph, you have to say korinu. You know, I say it in the Ashkenazic so you can hear it's a comments, okay? Korinu. Korinu, this is typical, right? Yeah, okay, very good. No, obviously the instinct is there. Okay, yeah, so that this is part of the language of the Mishnah. It's Hebrew, but as you can see, it's already undergone some changes since the time of the Tanakh, okay? All right, so, Tanu Rabbanan. So now we quote some other sources that are relevant to the same question, all right? By the way, I think we'll take first a little the Tosfos. Tosfos, the third Tosfos on the page, because that's the reference to the mission. It says, Masa Rabban Gamliel, Shenosa Isha, Vekora Kriya, Shema Malay Rishon, right? So, Tosfos is saying, Lav Masa Listahu. It says, this story is not being told to us in order to contradict what has gone before. Usually when we have what we call a ma'aseh listor, it means that first you state something and then all of a sudden you come up with a story in order to point out what? The opposite. The contrary is true. And as a result of the ma'aseh listor, then normally we come to a conclusion which is different from the first premise that had been laid down. Okay? So Tosfos is telling us over here that this is not a Masa Lista. The Kamash Malon im Godol Hu Vatech V'yatzmo Sheyuchal Yizkavei M'Hurohi Litos Hashem or Eshus B'yoda. Because what are we learning from the story of Rabban Gamliel? Not a general rule that, you know, anybody can come and say, okay, I am in the same category as Rav Gamliel. I am a great Talmid Chacham, and therefore I feel that I must have that Kavanah by reciting Krishna, whereas the average Chassan doesn't have it. So what we're saying is that this story is not contradicting the general rule that we lay down, that the Chassan is potter from saying Krishna by the Rishana. Okay? Now, by the way, the halacha today is that since none of us can really measure up to a Rav Gamliel, so that therefore we should all say it. Just the opposite of what the Mishnah says. But if you want to go by the Mishnah, you still have good authority for it. Okay? Because halacha, until recently, remained you had the privilege of being excused from citing Krishna. But if you feel that you want to say it, you're not committing an avera by reciting the Krishna. Alright, so this is what he said. I mean, that it's not to contradict, but only to say that in Godolhu, the man is really a great person. And he has enough self-confidence, Sheyuchale his kavein, you know, that he will have the proper kavanah when it comes to saying Krishna. This is the underline. And he is worthy, really, that he should be considered a what? That he can claim the title of being a Godol, a Talmud Chacham, you know what I mean? A Godol B'Torah, we would say. Then in that case, so it should be a Godol. He has the privilege of either reciting it or not. But we're trying to say that not everybody measures up to this business of considering himself a Godol. All right. The Gemara continues, and it says, Chon Rabbo. We learn the following in the Tesepta, says, Ho umnin korin barosha ilon, right? That artisans can read the Krishna at the top of the tree, uvarosha nidbok, and on the top of the stone wall, right? So far, it's exactly the same as the Mishnah. But here comes the difference. Umispalalin, and they can also recite Shmona Esrei, the Rosh HaZayis, at the top of an olive tree, Uberosh Hata'eno, or on the top of a fig tree. Usha'or kol ho'ilonos, but if they're working on the top of any other tree, Yodim Lamato Mispaladin, then they have to come down from the tree and they recite the Shmona Esrei. Now, of course, the question is then, what is the difference? Why do they single out the olive tree or the fig tree as being permissible to recite Shmona Esrei over there, whereas in the case of any other tree, they have to come down? Well, Avka, I mean, there are plenty of other trees too that Eretz Yisrael has. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's among, but I don't know, how about the palm tree? The date palm? Yeah, could be.
Well, do they grow very tall?
The olive doesn't grow that tall, really. If you've seen olive trees, of course they're very hardy, they can last for centuries if everything is right.
The funniest is a big fig tree there.
Yeah.
It's higher than this room.
Yeah.
It's
depends on the age and everything else. Okay, well, anyway, let's take a look at the Rashi. Rashi explains. Says, "Mispalin barosh hazayis barosh hateidon." Why? Says, "Bizman she'oskin bahen." This is true if they're busy working over there, that they can say Shmona Esrei at the top of either the olive tree or the fig tree. Why? Mipnei she'anfeihem merubim. First of all, because they have many, many branches. V'yakolin la'amod sham shelo b'dochak. And therefore they could stand there without having to apply too much pressure in order to do it. In other words, they can do it easily enough, since there are plenty of branches. V'yain sham pachad lipol. And they're not afraid that they're going to fall from it because they have so many branches to protect them as they fall. Therefore, they are permitted to recite Shmona Esrei on the top of these two trees. However, with the other trees, they're not allowed to recite Shmona Esrei. All right, so we learned already that there's an exception to the general rule that we had in the Mishnah about the Shmona Esrei, they have to come down. We learned exception number one, that if they're working on the top of either a fig tree or an olive tree, they can say Shvanes over there for the reason that Rashi quoted. Now, exception number two. Uval habayis ben kach uven kach yored lemato mispalel lefi shein dato miyushevas olam. Exception number two is the owner, the balabais, the person who owns, in this particular case, let's say, the trees. He's the owner of the trees. Now, obviously, what is it? He has employees who are working for him, okay? But he must come down and recite Shemon Esra because his mind is not really set upon the fact, you know, that he has to finish the work up there. This is the point. A person who is engaged, who is hired to work, right? He wants to earn his keep. And in those days, I mean, workers were expected to, you know, to be honest. If they engaged, you know, to work with this and this, then they worked at it, you see. So that the recital of Shemon Esra, the time that it would have taken them for them to come down and to go up again and resume the work, you see, is a loss in time. Now, obviously, if danger is involved, as we said, Shor Kol Ilonos, you know, the other kinds of trees that they must come down, well, okay, this we can understand. The danger, and therefore the lack of kavona, outweighs the amount of time that they lose by coming down and going up, and you know, the time that is consumed in reciting Shemon Esra. Okay? But in the case of the Balabas, he owns the trees, he does not have to work for it. He can let the workers work while he comes down. Well, if that's the case, then we say, Mr. Balabas, you come down. If you're not a worker, you come down in order to dump. So that this is what the Tosefta says over here. Okay? He has to come down and he recites the Shemon. His mind is not set upon you know, having to fulfill the work. Alright, so Rav Mori, the son, Berah, of the daughter of Shmuel. Very, very unusual thing, because normally we give a name and, you know, and whose name follows. Is it normally the father's name or the mother's name? Right, in almost every case it's the father's name. And here they are referring to this great Rav as being the son of the daughter of Shmuel. So anyway, I'll come back to that in a second. So he asked the following objection or following question to Rava. He said, "Nam, we have learned in the Mishnah, Ha'umnin Korin Barosh Ilona Rosh Hanidbo, that the workers have to read the Krishma at the top of the tree and at the top of the wall or the scaffold or whatever you want to say. Alma, so if that's the case, Lord Boy Kavona. We would say, therefore, that they don't really need kavona in order to say what? In order to say krishma. If you say they don't have to come down, it means that they're not requiring them to have kavona when they say krishma. But how does this jive with the fact that we've said, Raminhu, we objected? Because what did we say? We said, Hakore Yeshma, whoever recites the krishma, Tzorach Sheikhavein Es Libon, he has to have, you know, the concentration of his heart upon it. In other words, he has to feel that he is wholeheartedly devoting himself to reciting the Shema and to what the ideas are that the Shema contains. So it's a contradiction. Of course, what is the basis of that we have to have Kavanah and Shema? Shenemar, it's written Shema Yisrael. Well, a halon, and a little bit further, who Omer, it says, Haskes Shema Yisrael, give ear, in other words, pay attention, in other words, concentrate, and then say Shema Yisrael. So Mala Halon Bahaskes, if in the latter case you have to have that concentration, so Av Kan, in that case, when they're up on the tree, also that they have to have concentration. Right? Av Kan, the asovas. In other words, they also should have to have, you know, when they are leaning up in the tree and so on. So he says, ishtik. He was quiet. He didn't know what to say. Didn't know how to reply. So Amale, he said to him, Midi shami alecha b'ho, tell me, have you heard anything at all about this particular question that I'm asking you? Namely, the contradiction between the two. So Amale, so he said to him, Hochi yomar Rab Sheshes. This is what Rab Sheshes said. He said, Behu shebetelim im lachton v'kore. It says, when is it that, you know, they are given permission that they have to concentrate very, very hard on the Shema, and therefore they should be coming down presumably and so on? This is when they are is that they shouldn't, you know, infringe upon the amount, and then that they only need a certain minimum concentration, so to speak, in order to recite the Kriya Shema. The Hotanya, so they say, but look, didn't we learn in another Tosefta which says, Beis Hillel Omrin, that Beis Hillel say, Oskim Bimlacht on the Koran, that they should continue with their work, whatever they're doing, and read Krishna? So he says, Lo Kasha. He says, in reality, this is not a contradiction. Or Beperik Rishon, or Beperik Sheni. In the first paragraph of the Shema, you do have to have concentration, but once you've gone beyond the first paragraph of the Shema, then you don't have to concentrate so much upon what you're saying, and therefore you could stop for a moment, let's say, recite the first paragraph of the Shema, and then continue with your work, and that would not be a terrible abuse of time at the expense of the employer.
Is every type of tree, the sheep,
Presumably, of course, they're not there in order to saw down the limbs, because then they better get down.
They're harvesting.
Right, but they're harvesting fruit, okay?
They can do the whole Kriya Shema. The idea is that they will have the Kavana to do a thing on the top of a tree.
Because they are secure. But with Krishna, it said that they don't have to come down, which Monesri did say that they have to come down, but then they made the exception to Sefta, with the two trees, the Zayat and the Tena. Okay.
But Krishna, they will have a valid Kavanah being at the top of the tree.
Right. But this contradicts the fact that we should have Kavanah for the whole thing, right? And so therefore, what is the conclusion that they come to? They say, Hod the Perikrishon, Hod the Periksheni. In other words, to recite the first paragraph of the Shema, they should really stop for a moment and concentrate upon what it is that they're saying. But once they get to the second paragraph of the Shema, then they could continue, they don't have to come down, and they could continue with their work, Oskim Bimlachtam, right? They're permitted to continue the work while they're reciting the Shema. So that they don't need the same type of kavana for the second and third paragraph of the Shema as they need for the first paragraph of the Shema. Still a problem.
Of course.
Okay. Right. Well.
All right. Okay.
That's Labdapka, we say. Right. Okay.
Now we're on the top of the tree.
Yeah.
And you have a proper kavanah to say.
For a moment, take the proper kavanah to say Shema. This is the idea. I'm sure of that. I mean, these are people, after all, they're called Umnin. Umnin is not just an ordinary, worker who is hired for the day in order to do some specific task. And Uman already implies that he has a certain skill in him. And in other words, he's a skilled worker, you see. This is the difference between the Uman and the Poel. If I wanted to say just an ordinary worker, then I say Poel. At least this is the language of the Talmud, okay? But the Uman already represents a person who has a craft, he has a skill. He has more than, just being an ordinary worker hired in order to simply do whatever job the boss tells him to do. Pardon me? Poel? Yeah. No, it's Pevov, I am. Yeah, right. Yeah, that means an ordinary worker. Like, for example, in Bob Mitzia, they speak about Hatzoka as Hapoel. Yeah, they have two chapters, by the way. One is Hatzoka as Hapoel, and the other one is Hatzoka as Umnit. In other words, there's a difference as to the degree of skill and everything else, and what is the contract that you make with them as the terms of employment. So they represent two different types. I mean, just as, for example, an Uman is somebody who, if he wants to, can go into business for himself, so to speak, as a craftsman. But the point is that he's skilled. So that obviously, if he's skilled in working on the top of the tree, where the average workman perhaps would not feel comfortable over there, so that therefore he can concentrate at least for the few minutes that it takes to concentrate on the first paragraph of the Shema.
I understand. That's the assumption.
Yeah, that's the assumption,
so
right.
Experience like the tree trimmers.
Yeah.
Today, in our time, that he feels as comfortable hanging on a limb 20 meters up
right.
as we would standing in front of a counter in a store.
Correct, correct.
In front of a classroom
yeah.
or something.
Yeah. Yeah. So the human does imply, as I say, that he has a certain skill and experience and so on, which the average worker, you see, does not have. Yeah. Right. All right, let's take a look at the Rashi from where we left off over here. Okay. We said that the Balabas, going back again over there, Bankoff of Bankoff, makes no difference whether he's working, you know, if let's say the Balabas decided to go up on top of the tree also to work together with the craftsman, right? Or maybe he's decided to work by himself. Who knows? Let's say he just, you know, he's a one man. He knows how to do it, so he climbs up the tree and he starts into the big fruit over there, okay? And lo and behold, it's time to recite Krishna. Does he have the right to stay up on the tree and recite the Krishna, or recite even the Shmona Esra, according to the statement of Tosefta, which says, you know, on these two trees he can be more sure and, you know, and say even the Shmona Esra, or not? So we said, no, Bankoff of Bankoff makes no difference what type of tree, as Rashi says, Kolomer. In other words, Bain Mitaino or Bain Mishorilon, makes no difference whether we're talking about the fig tree or simply other trees, the Balabas Yore de Mispalot. He has to come down and recite the Shmona Esra. Why? The Ho Eino Mishubot de Mlocha. Because he is not literally enslaved to the work. Shehu Birshus Atzmo. After all, he's independent. And so therefore, if he's independent, he's not doing it at the expense of the Balabas. Therefore, what does he have to do? He comes down. No, as I say, I mean, he is an independent person. He's an independent contractor. He owns it. So that, therefore, he has to come down. Makes no difference, because he should have more kavanah. Why? Because we say, Lefi shein datam yushevet alav, because his mind is not at ease with him. Miba'u susa, because there is a certain amount of fear involved. In other words, the Balabas maybe is not really as skilled as the skilled person is, you know, who goes to work for him. And so therefore there's a certain amount of fear. The im hekelo etzul po'alim, mitnei bitul melocho, lo hekelo etzul abal habat. So that if the chachomim were a little easy when it came to workers, in other words, giving them permission to stay up on the tree and not to come down, because they did not want that the workers should do their work faithlessly, right? In other words, that they would cast aside the work obligation that they had in order to daven. They didn't want that. They did not want the worker to take advantage of the Balabas. Of course, I mean, if the boss also has an agreement with the workers, you understand, he has to honor that too, you see. It's a two-way business. So, lo hekelo etzel balabais. But in the case of the Balabas, they did not exercise the skula. They wanted him to come down and do it. All right. So now, the question was raised by Rav Mori, Berod of Shmuel, right? The son of the daughter of Shmuel. So the question is, the Kama Mekoma is Korilei Bar Rochel. In many places in the Talmud, they call him Mori Bar Rochel. In other words, who was his mother? Mother was Rochel. And who was he? Uva Shmuel Hayisa. She was the daughter of Shmuel, you know, the great Shmuel, who was the one of the great teachers of the Talmud of Babylonia. Benishbeis Levein Hoamim. And she was taken a prisoner by Goyim. You know, in those days they used to raid one country and another, and very often they would seize people, make them, you know, into slaves. They would imprison them and make slaves of them. Kedoma b'ksuvus, and as we find the story in ksuvus, uvo eleha echad, and a certain goy had intercourse with her, v'nisabro hemeno, and she became pregnant from him. V'yachar kein nisgayer, and afterwards this goy, he became converted. Ushamei Isur, and his name happened to be Isur. Kedamin of Baba Basra, as we find in Gemara Baba Basra. Rav Mori Berei, or Raso Shalobik Dusha Haba. We find that Rav Mori, his son, was not conceived in Kedusha. In other words, when the father impregnated the mother, the father had not yet become Jewish. Okay? Now, naturally, the son was Jewish, I mean, because his mother is Jewish, okay? But you cannot call him how? By the name of his father. You understand? Cannot call him by his father's name. So, Lechach, for this reason, Lo Hayo Nikra al Shem Aviv, he was not called, you know, by the name of his father. If the father had become converted before, right, and they got married, so then of course he's a Jew for all purposes, and there's no problem, you see, in calling him by the father's name, right. But where the father was a goy at the time that the child was conceived, so in that particular case, he's not called by his father's name. Of course, this is what I guess ideally it should be, but I don't have to tell you that. Well, today probably I wouldn't be surprised that if, you know, a guy first impregnated a Jewish woman and then afterwards he decided to convert and marry her, that undoubtedly they would give the child anyway the name of the father for the sake of peace, it would sound better and everything else. But in the time of the Talmud, as you can see, they were much more careful. And remember, we learned in Kedushin this whole concept, you know, about Yuchsin, that you want to be conscious of what is the pedigree. If he's a Kohen, he has to have a certain yichus. A Levi has to have a certain yichus. A Yisrael has a yichus as compared to a Geir, you know, a proselyte, and so on. And we learned that there were different degrees and restrictions. As, for example, we learned let's say the daughter of a Kohen should not be married to a Geir and things like that. So, you know, in order to preserve the Kedusha, you see. So, these are certain things that we learned. Or rather, So, they were more concerned then with preserving the Yichus, with preserving, you know, the status, the purity of the family line, and so on and so forth. David.
I'm sorry. In the Gemara, it says, Rami
Ray,
right?
Yeah, Rami. Yeah, okay. Right, right.
Mori.
Correct.
Now, Farad Shabbat Shmuel.
Correct.
It doesn't say Rav Mori, then Rachel Shabbat Shmuel.
Okay. Okay.
Maybe if you just go over these words, I guess I'm
sure. Sure, that's okay. All right. Alright, so he says, let me go back again. It says, okay, Rami is a verb.
Okay.
Rami means literally raised against him. In other words, questioned him.
Okay.
Alright? Rami lay, Rav Mori. Rav Mori questioned. Who did he question? Well, Rav Mori, the son of the Vashmuel. Yeah, in this case, Barah is like saying her son of the daughter of Shmuel, okay? You know that in the language of the Gemara, and this is done in Hebrew today, okay? If I wanted to say, alright, let's say Agnon's story, okay? Agnon's story. in pure Hebrew, what would we say? We would say Sipur Agnon. Okay? The story of Agnon. But in the time of the Talmud, on the basis, you can see, this is the kind of the language, you know, as the language developed, so other constructions came into play. And to this day, modern Hebrew has retained, I would say, most of them. Here and there, maybe it's discarded, you know, like instead of saying Korinu, as the Talmud say, they went back again to saying Koranu, right? But how would I say Agnon's story today? I would say Sipuro Shel Agnon. Now, what does Sipuro mean? His story of Agnon, right? But naturally, what does it really mean? Sipuro Shel Agnon means Agnon's story. So the same thing over here. Beror, literally her son, Devash Shmuel, of Shmuel's daughter, okay? But in English, you would say the son of Shmuel's daughter. That's all that it is, okay? So that's how the words fit together over there. All right. Now, let's continue with the Rashi over here first. Okay. Tanan. We now bring the Mishnah, which says, Umnin kon b'rosh ha'ilon, right? And what is the implication of the Mishnah? The implication is, Afilu bizban shehein atzukin. Even when they are busy, right? They read at the top of the tree. So Almo, from this we learn what? Lo boy kavona. They do not require kavona when they recite the Shema. Because if you say, when they're busy working, you know, they recite Krishna, the implication is that they are not even required to have kavona, even for the first paragraph. So, why? Shebetelim im lachtam akorin. We learn that they can take a moment off from their work and read. Why? Kedei sheyehu korin b'kavono, in order for them to read the kavono, rashoyin, they are permitted lihibotel mimlachton, to take a moment off from their work, so that they could say Krishna with kavono. But for what? Perek rishon, parsha shema boye kavono. In other words, you know, shema Yisrael v'yohavta, this requires kavono. But how about, you know, the rest, Perek Sheni, as we said? Perek Sheni, already you don't have to have the same kavana, so they continue working and at the same time recite the Shema. So this is how Rashi explains then what we have over here in the text. Okay. Tana Rabbanan. Another quotation taken from the Tosefta. It says, HaPoalim shehoyu osim melocha eitzel balabayis. Workers, here as I said before, Paul in is the ordinary worker, they're not necessarily a skilled worker, okay? Ordinary workers who were doing some kind of work together with the balabos, okay? Korin kriyashma, they recite Krishna, umborachim leponehu lachareho, and they recite the brachas that come before the Shema and the brachas that follow the Shema. The Yochlin Piton, and then they eat their piece of bread. Umevorchim Ponehul Acharehu, and they have to recite the Hamotzi beforehand and the Birkas Hamotzin afterwards, right? Umis Palalin Tfilah Shel Shmona Esrei, and they can then daven the Shmona Esrei. Incidentally, to me, the thing that strikes me is the fact that after saying Krishna, what do they do? They eat. And then after what? And then they first finish the rest of the davening and say Shmoneh Esrei. Because normally this is not a recommended practice. Why not? Because we've already learned why not. That you have to be so meir, Yehuda Litfila. I mean, that after you finish the Brocha, Baruch HaRashem, Goal Yisrael, it's a mitzvah to immediately begin with the Shmoneh Esrei. So that therefore we wouldn't think today of doing this, you know, to first say Krishna and then eating and then first getting back to the Shmoneh Esrei. Today we would say the first thing they have to do is to say Krishna and Shmoneh Esrei, and then after that you sit down to eat, okay? But anyway, what do you notice from this? You notice that over here, that if they're working together with the balabas, then what? They could take the time out in order to do what?
to daven with the proper brachas before and after, to when they sit down to eat, they have to make hamotzi, and they have to say the, you know, the full benching afterwards. You follow me? And this is not considered what? It's not considered an interruption of the work agreement, so to speak, that they gave to the boss, that they would put in their time working for him. This is because, of course, the boss is there together with them. Okay? Right. Now, but there are certain things they cannot do in order to prolong the davening. What can't they do? Ein yodin le'hateva, first of all, they don't go up to daven for the omid during this time. And secondly, the einosin kapehem, nor do they go and, duchen. Of course, remember that in Eretz Yisrael, duchening is something which is done every day. And for several centuries, even, you know, outside of Eretz Yisrael, this was still a practice which was followed in many communities, that they duchened every day. For some reason or other, as time went on, because of hardships, and they felt that it was too much to expect the Kohanim to go to Duchen every single day, would prolong the service too much, etc., etc., etc. So we got away from it, and today, if anybody would go up to Duchen over here in the shul in the morning, or even on Shabbos morning, we would say, hey, what are you doing over there? Matter of fact, you know that even about Shabbos and Yom Tov, there is a difference of opinion as to whether the Kohanim should Duchen or not. The Kadima Minhag is the Kain does not Duchen. But there are plenty of shuls where they say that if Yom Tov is Shabbos, you still Duchen. What do they leave out? They leave out the Rebbeinu Shleilim and things like that. That they leave out. Okay? But that the Kohanim go and recite the Bracha in Duchen, this they do on Shabbos. David?
Duchening in Eretz Israel.
Yeah.
What you're saying is not only on Shabbat in Yerushalayim, every day in all.
Every day in Yerushalayim. In Yerushalayim, they duchen every day. Outside of Yerushalayim, some do and some don't. There are many shuls, for example, like in Tel Aviv, Haifa, and so on, that they duchen only on Shabbos and Yom Tov. But Shabbos, they do duchen over there. It's just during the week that they don't do. But in Yerushalayim, Kohanim duchen every single day. And that would also be true in general of the area around Yerushalayim, too. Alright, so they're not privileged then to prolong the service by being a chazan or by going up to Duchen, but apart from that, they can certainly recite the Bulshem and Esra, etc., etc. The Hor Tanya, but didn't we learn Me'ein Yudches, that they did, that they should recite an abbreviated form of the Shmona Esra? We'll take a look at that in a second. So Omar Rav Sheshes said Lekashi, he says Dadakashi. Hor Rabban Gamliel, Hor Rabbi Yoshua. This business as to whether to recite a full Shmoneh Esrei or to recite only an abbreviated version of the Shmoneh Esrei, this is a point of difference, a machlokes between Rabbi Gamliel, who says that you have to recite every day the full Shmoneh Esrei, as compared to Rabbi Yehoshua, who said that you can recite an abbreviated form of the Shmoneh Esrei. So the Gemara asked the following question, is my Yiriya Po'alim, so what are you asking, what are you giving me an example about workers? Afilu kol odom name. Every person either has the choice of doing a full Shmoneh Esrei, if you follow Rabbi Gamliel's opinion, or doing an abbreviated one, according to Rabbi Yehoshua. So it has nothing to do with, whether they're workers or not.
What's an abbreviated?
I'll show it to you in a second, okay? But rather, both opinions follow Rabbi Gamliel, but Okashin, it's not a Kashin. Khan the Oisin Biskoron. When a worker works for his wage, and the wage includes also the fact that the Balabas agrees to give him his lunch. Okay? Breakfast, his lunch, whatever it may be. The Balabas agrees that the meals are part of the part of the agreement. Then in that particular case, we said he can daven recite the prophets before and after. He can recite Shemoneh Esrei, full Shemoneh Esrei. He doesn't have to say the abbreviated Shemoneh Esrei, okay? And he can also recite the benching, say, recite first of all, you know, the Hamotzi before the meal, and then to recite the full benching after the meal. This is, if this is the agreement, that they get a wage, and the wage includes also a meal's allowance, okay? However, what if people work only in order to get a meal allowance? Obviously, some people apparently were so poor that they were glad to work just in order to be able to get a meal. So in that particular case, they cannot take advantage of it, and, you know, they have to do things, you know, as fast as they possibly can. The Hor Tanya, and didn't we learn in another Tosefta, which says, "Hafalim shoyosim melocha etz balabai is koring krishma mispalan v'yochad pitan v'yemivochim faneho." Didn't we learn that if workers are working with the balabas, they recite krishma, they say Shemoneh Esrei, the yochlin pitan, then they sit down, they have the meal, right? The ein mivochim faneho, they do not recite the hamotzi before the meal, aval mivochim liacharei hashtayim. But instead, they recite a, but they do say a benchin afterwards, but also what kind of a benchin? Two brachas. What does it mean, two brachas? It means also an abbreviated type of benchin. So we'll see what they are in just a moment. Ketzad, what do we mean by the two brachas? So he says, bracha rishoino kesikuno, you have to say the first bracha, in other words, hazon es ha'olam kulei b'tuvai, etc., etc., that you say without making any changes in it. And then shniya, the second bracha of the benchin, paseach bebirkas ha'aretz, you start in with no delafor, the cholelim boni Yerushalayim, and you also include the idea of the rebuilding of Jerusalem, which is, of course, normally the third bracha, right? Bebirkas ha'aretz, and this bracha for praising God for having given us the land. So, Bamed Devarim Amurim, what are we talking about? It's Ve'osim Mischorim. This is where we are saying, you know, that if they are working for themselves, okay, here the Tosefta says just the opposite of what I said before. It says Ve'osim Mischorim, if they are working for both a wage and a meal, then in that case, what do they have to do? They have to cut short what they say at the mealtime. They can daven and so on, we say, but according to this Tosefta, right? According to this Tosefta, they can say Krishma, they can say Shemoneh Esrei, but when it comes to the meal, they don't say Hamotzi, and they give only an abbreviated benchin, as we saw just a moment ago, afterwards. Avol Osim Misudosan. However, if they are working in order to receive the Suda, I mean, this is what they're working for. Oh, Shoyo Balabais Mesiv Mohem, or if, let's say, the Balabas was having lunch together with them, they would sat down, they ate together, then Mevorachim Kesikuna, they have to recite the Brachas the right way. In other words, recite the Hamotzi beforehand, and to recite the full benchin afterwards. Okay, now, question is, what is this abbreviated Shemoneh Esrei? What is the abbreviated benchin?
Well, we'll take a look at Bernard, because he certainly includes the abbreviated Shemoneh Esrei.
Alright, let's see first of all what the abbreviated Shemoneh Esrei looks like. Okay, let's turn to right after the Amida, the Shacharis Amida service, page 97. Alright, you see where he says abridge Shemoneh Esrei, the only thing is, what he forgot to tell you is what he is supposed to do over here. Okay? what you're supposed to do, and of course this has been, excuse me, for emergency situations. It's not been for normal things. I mean, this is how we postulate today, okay? That if you have an emergency situation, let's say, you know, you're quite sick, you want to daven, you want to say Shemoneh Esrei, but you don't have the strength, let's say, to do the whole thing. Or, let's say, you have a very pressing engagement, you must leave immediately, but you want to get in at least a minimum of davening, you know, before you go, you have this emergency situation. Then what you do is to recite the first three brachas first, you know, Oves and Atah Gibor and Atah Kodosh and so on. You say those three first. Then instead of the middle section beginning with Atah Honein and ending with Shamei Atah Filo, you say this abridged bracha. And then after that you say Ritzei and Modim and Sim Shalom. Okay, or Shalom Rov, whatever it may be. Now let's take a look at a moment. We'll see what it is. Havineinu Hashem Elokeinu L'das Rochecha, right? Teach us, O Lord our God, give us the wisdom, right, to learn your ways. Okay? Obviously, this corresponds to what bracha? Atochaninum Das, exactly. Okay? Umolis Lovavenu Yerosecha, literally circumcise our heart, that, you know, we may hear you. Of course, this is, you know, the second bracha. Right? Okay? Then the Sislach Lonu Liyoski Ulam. This is a combination of two brachas, actually. Sislach Lonu, of course, forgive us. That's, you know, Slach Lonu, right? And Liyoski Ulam, that we may be redeemed, of course, is the bracha. Goel Yisrael, right. Goel Yisrael, right? Then, you know, Reino of Yonyenu, Rilvenu, etc. Okay? Then, Veracha Kenu Mimachol. Keep us far from illness. Of course, this is Rufahinu, right? V'dashneinu binos tach artecha, and enabled us to enjoy the fullness of, you know, your land. In other words, that we may have, you know, a land blessed with all kinds of food and prosperity. Naturally, this is Borech Aleinu, okay? Unafutzoseinu miyavakampes horas dekabes. This, of course, is the kabeshev gadol. You know, the Katsina Yachim Elkansu. Ihatoim al Datko Yishafetu, and may those who are, you know, who stray from knowledge of you, may they be judged, as of course is Hoshiva Shoftein Kivorishoino, right? And then the Al Horishoim Tanif Yodecho, this of course is for the Malshinim, okay? The Yismichu Tzadikim, and may the righteous rejoice. Naturally, this would be Allah Tzadikim, right? And then the Dinyan Irecho V'Sikun Heicholecho. This would be, of course, Bonei Yerushalayim, right? Uvitz Michas Keren Adovid Abdecho Barichas Nele Ben Yishai Mishikecho. This phrase, of course, is the idea of the Semach Dovid, okay? And finally, Nikra Atos Haner. Before we call upon you, may you answer our prayers. And of course, it's Rishma Kedleinu, right? Baruch HaKvar Hashem, Shamei HaTefillin, and as I said, you continue with Ritzei and so on. So that, this is the abridged version. However, the Gemara, in discussing it, and we'll learn it a little bit later this year, Yitz Hashem, it says that while this may be recited in emergencies, there are times when it may not be recited. When may it not be recited? The answer is under the following circumstances. First of all, Saturday night, you don't recite it. Why not? Of course, you have to add Havdalah, and there's no provision for Havdalah over here. Understand? Another thing for which there's no provision is during the winter months when we have to say what?
Mashiv
Baruch is, that's the beginning, right? But it's saying Talamot of the Baruch, that's the answer. When we say Talamot, right, during the time we say Talamot, again, there's no provision for that over here. So on those two occasions, we do not. We're not permitted to say the abridged version because you're leaving out an essential idea that you should be including in the Shemoneh Esrei. But otherwise, as you see, this has it.
December 4th through
Pesach. Right.
No.
Yeah. All right, now let's see if I can find over here an abridged version of the benching. If it's not here, then it's in the little white bencher that we have. Well, let me see. 777. maybe, I don't know. Okay, here we have the Birchas of Muslim. Yeah, okay, the full benching over here begins, you're absolutely right, on page 759 it begins. All right, let's take a look at the end. No, I'll tell you what we have on page 771, while it really is an abridged form of the, you know, the Birkas HaMozon, but this specifically is recited after we have cake, you know, or after we have certain fruits like figs, dates, pomegranates, grapes, or after wine, so then we recite this. So this is not the one that I had in mind. See if there's anything more over here. No, they don't have it in this book. Okay. Okay, I don't want to run into the kitchen right now to see if we have one of the little benchers. But the little bencher, it's not really correct either. Because the little bencher has what they call a birkas HaMozon li'ilodim. In other words, the children are teaching, you know, how to begin benching. So we don't really have the abridged version. So let me tell you right now what the abridged version is. The abridged version, first of all, we said the first bracha is on its oilam that you have to say in its entirety. The second one, as we said, runs something along the lines of Neidu Lekor Hashem Lekenu, right? Ashil Chapa Lasenu Eretz Hem the Torah Chavor the Torah, etc., etc. And then it says of Neidu Yerushalayim Yerakodesh Benuimin. I mean, roughly, this is the way it runs. And it winds up with the bracha, you know, something like to the effect that Baruch HaKadosh Hashem, I guess B'nai Yerushalayim is probably the way it ends up. But the idea is that I'd have to see, because we don't have any text over here that really has that version. But you're supposed to include Bris, Eretz, and Torah in this. Bris, of course, we thank God, you know, Al Bris Koshka Santa Bitsomenu, the covenant that he made with us. Eretz, you know, the idea that we thank God for the good land, you know, Lord Sapeva. And Torah, again, you know, that the Rosko Shilimaditon, you see. So these elements must be present over there in the bracha. But we also have to have the element then of Bonei Yerushalayim as well. So this is what it is. Yes.
Well, when would we do this? When would there be a circumstance that you would have?
Okay. For us, really, there isn't any great circumstance that requires it, unless we're under, again, such awful pressure, you know, that we must run and we want to say some form of a benching, you know, that will fulfill at least a very minimum requirement of it. That's the only circumstance under which we could. Now, since we're on this, let me just add two more words, and with that we'll complete our class for tonight. First of all, in reality, the benching ends with Tatov HaMeitiv. The Yolam Al Yachasreinu, this is strictly speaking the end of the brachos of the benching. So that everything that comes from that point on, you know, all the harachmons, etc., etc., this is all like an addendum, so to speak. It's been added on to the benching. So that if for some reason or other, again, you're under pressure and you don't, then you could stop at the Olam Al Yechasrenu at that particular point. Okay? Because with that, you have said all the brachas of the benching itself. The other question is, of course, you know, why are they excused from reciting the Hamotzi? The answer is because, as the Gemara will learn towards the end of the brachas, coming to the final chapter, the bracha of Hamotzi is considered a bracha midirabbanan. In other words, the rabbis ordained that we should make this bracha, whereas Hazan, this is considered a bracha d'oraisa, it's a mitzvah d'oraisa, because the Torah tells us we are called to the sabota uveirachta, so that's why it says that, you know, under the pressure you're working for the Bala boss, and you know he demands you to be accountable for just about every minute of time that he's paying you for. So you can skip, we said, the Hamotzi, which is after only the Rabbanon, and but have this abbreviated benching, because benching is still Midoraisman, therefore you should say it. So that's the reasoning behind it. Stanley, did you have a question or not? All right, so at this particular point then, we shall call a halt for tonight. Amir Hashem, we will continue next week. Okay, we shall continue now on Tet Zion Amud Aleph, from where we left off last time. Okay?
Okay.
Going back to the top of the page a little before, where we had the Mishnah, and of course the Mishnah dealt with different things, okay? The first thing, if you remember, the one that we discussed last week, was the fact that workers can read the Krishna if they're working on top of a tree or on top of a row of masonry, whatever it may be, but they're not allowed to say Shmonesra that way. That was what the Mishnah said, and then of course we discussed it and we discovered that there are exceptions to this. That, for example, what kind of a tree has to be a fig tree or the olive tree, because they are sturdy up on top. But if you have a tree which is not sturdy on top, you better come down. And then we discussed about with the boss, what is the story, and under what terms, for example, when it comes to food, I mean, is food the what they're being paid, or are they eating together with the boss and so on? And this would affect as to whether they should recite the full Birkat HaMazon, whether they are excused from making the Hamotzi or not, and so on. So that this is what we discussed last week. Alright, now comes the second part of the Mishnah to be discussed, and that one says that Chosen Potem Kriya Shema Laila HaRishon Aviyat Matzei Shabbos, that a Chosen is excused from reciting Krishma the first night of his marriage until the Motzei Shabbat, until the end of the until the Shabbos is over. Now of course, what are we talking about? We're talking about where in those days it was customary for marriage to take place on a Wednesday night, and the reason why is that because on Thursday the Beis Din would meet, so that if he discovered that his bride was not a virgin, he could come into the Beis Din in order to protest and say that his wife was not, he married the girl in all good faith. He discovered that she was not a virgin in spite of the fact that she and her parents claimed that she was. And as a result of that, as we said, she could lose the ksuba. And we discussed, if you remember last time, what is in the ksuba and how much financial.
Because, the Gomorrah, they just have really good.
Right.
As an equivalent of other monetary
amounts. Yes. Well, so, well, we don't know. But anyway, it was still considered a fairly substantial amount of money. Uh-huh. That's the point, you see. Was considered a fairly substantial amount of money, and therefore, if he felt that he was being gypped, so that therefore her punishment was, you see, that she would lose the ksuba. Okay. Which would be, of course, a tremendous financial loss for her. The question that the Gemara Ksubas wants to know is something different. They want to know, why should the guy want to make up a story in the first place, in case, he's telling an untruth, okay? So they say the presumption is that he would not be telling a lie. Why? Because it's cost him so much money in order to pay for the chasanet, invite the guests and everything else, get her house arrangements, so on and so forth, that if he went to the Beis Din, it wouldn't be, simply in order to spite her, but, he felt, that after so much investment that he put in, then he deserved to have a virgin bride. So that's how the Gemara explains it over there, that he wouldn't do it deliberately. Of course, we know, in the Torah we know that sometimes presumption doesn't hold, because of the fact that we do have, the case mentioned about the man who comes and he says, "Lo matzasi levitcha b'sulam," I did not find tokens of virginity, you know, in your daughter whom I marry. And so the idea is that if it is so, then in that case, of course, she would be punished. But if he's telling a lie and they find out that it is, then in that case he can never divorce her. And not only that, but he has to pay her father a fine of 50 shekalim and so on, which of course was quite a financial punishment, you know, to be placed upon. So that occasionally you did have a nasty possum, I suppose. But as I say, the Gemara and Kesubas figures that generally speaking, this is why I say, man has to come to the bed.